afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Bill, I've got a, here we go. I do have a promotion.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, I've got actually all the information this week.
Wow.
McDonald's, budget printing and copies. I'm throwing out another recommendation for them. If you live in the Reading area, they are at 2647 Bocelli Lane, and they are open Monday through Thursday, 8 to 5, and Fridays, 8 to 2, but I was there at 3 and they were still there, so Fridays are flexible. But they are great, and they'll whatever you're trying to print, big giant pictures, or you need a whole bunch of copies, or you need some quick, you know, business cards or something like that, these guys are terrific. So they are right by the bowling alley there. Liquor Barn and H&R Block. I probably should say H&R Block since a lot of people are probably just there. Those guys are terrific. Their phone number is 530-222-0322, but you should just go in, because every time I've needed something, I basically just waited, or I left for an hour and came back and it was done. So can't say that enough about businesses in town. Any other things we were supposed to announce?
We have a guest.
Bill's got the blank look.
Well, let's introduce our guest.
I have not stumped the panel in a long time, so no. You were due. All right. So today, we're chatting with a comedian. How great is that? You can't have too many comedians on Sunday. Oh, Salvador Ledvak. So excited. He has this terrific book, Let My People Laugh, The Greatest Jewish Jokes of All Time. And as a kid who grew up in Connecticut in a Jewish neighborhood, I gotta say, this is exciting for me. Let's see. He was born in Santiago, Chile, which was kind of confusing when I first saw that. Moved to New York at the age of 5. He's a graduate of Harvard College with an English degree. Went to NYU Law School. And it just says NYU Law School, but I did a little more homework. He actually got his law degree, passed the bar, and practiced law. Then he went to the School of Theater, Film, and Television at UCLA.
And that sounds like a lot more fun.
Practiced law and went, he'll tell us the rest. He wrote, produced, and directed Saving Lincoln, the true story of Abraham Lincoln leading the nation through the Civil War, as recounted by his close friend and bodyguard, U.S. Marshal Ward Hill Lehman. The film was made by capturing the actors' performances on green screen stage and creating all the sets and locations out of vintage Civil War photographs from the Library of Congress. Pretty neat. Named his visual style Cine Collage. His first film was a Passover comedy. Can't have too many Passover comedies. Out here in the West, I don't think they fully appreciate it, but in the East, guarantee you they watch this every year. It's called When Do We Eat? It stars Max Greenfield, Jack Klugman, Ben Fieldman, Cherie Appleby, Leslie Ann Warren. So, really cool people. He wrote both films with his wife, Nina. And he also blogs as the Accidental Talmudist for the Jewish Journal of Los Angeles. This all started, I got a thing from A.J. Rice that he had made comments on several things, actually. And the most recent was Trump backs the $5,000 baby bonus for new moms in a bid to reverse the declining birth rate. And he had has a fun post, and I'm not going to read it because that'll wreck it. I'm going to let him do it. Sal, how's it going?
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me on the show.
I like your thing, my pal Sal.
I am your pal Sal. We haven't even met yet, not your pal.
My pal Sal. I saw that. I was like, oh, yes. So were you funny in law school, and did they appreciate that?
There were a lot of dry people in law school, believe it or not. And that's probably why I'm a recovering attorney.
You went to court and you were like, what? It doesn't get more fun there either? Dang it. That's funny. I discovered that teaching. I went and got my credential and went to school. I was like, oh, my gosh, it's just like when I was a kid. I'm in trouble all the time.
You got to love what you do. And if you can say that, then you never work a day in your life.
Oh, there you go. Well, I have no idea where you'd like to start today, but we want to plug all your things, including your new film, Guns and Moses, which I just thought was hilarious. But it doesn't sound hilarious. It actually sounds kind of serious.
It's an action thriller. It's coming out this summer in theaters across America, starring Mark Feuerstein, Christopher Lloyd, Neil McDonough, and Dermot Mulroney. And it's a story of a rabbi whose community is violently attacked. And when the police won't investigate, he has to become the detective. And as he gets closer to the truth, the danger piles up. People get killed, and he has to learn how to use a gun and use it effectively. And the firearms training that the rabbi goes through in the movie is based on my own training in a security organization. You know, I didn't grow up as a gun guy, but I'm an Orthodox Jew. I'm a visible Jew, and there's a lot going on in the world now that's dangerous.
Yeah.
And so a lot of us have, you know, bought guns and learned how to use them and got licensed for CCW. And please God, we should never need these skills. But if we do, we will not be a soft target.
No, I think you're exactly right. And the people who think that that's unnecessary, what would you say to them? Just, you know.
I think wake up and join the real world. I mean,
yeah.
You know, my mother was a Holocaust survivor. My grandmother carried her as an infant to a concentration camp. Unbelievable, miracle story. And so the Holocaust is something she's very aware of all growing up. And we have this phrase, you know, never again.
Yep.
Well, for about 80 years after the Holocaust, it was at least, you know, unattractive or unfashionable for anti-Semites to spew their hatred, their racism out loud. That's over. People feel perfectly comfortable saying online, in person, on TV, they hate Jews, they want Jews dead, they want Israel eliminated. It's incredible. You know, and my grandmother, my mom, they always said, yeah, it could happen in America, too. And we're like, no, come on, not here, never here. Times have changed.
Are you shocked to, I guess you're really not, but I'll ask it. You had written also something about Harvard fighting Trump on the reasonable conditions. You know, here you're an alum of Harvard. And at the time when you were attending, I'm sure it was probably just fine.
I never experienced any anti-Semitism there. And now when I hear what's been going on, I mean, October 7th was the worst, most deadly day for Jews since the Holocaust. And October 8th, in many ways, was even worse. All of a sudden, erupting around America, you know, from the river to the sea, it eliminates Israel before Israel had even begun its response. It's incredible to me how many, you know, for lack of a better phrase, useful idiots there are in America who just allow themselves to be manipulated. And told that, yeah, the entire Middle East conflict can be reduced to white people are oppressing brown people, and therefore Israel is bad. It has nothing to do with that. Israelis are not white. The Palestinians are not brown. And the whole thing is fabricated. It's a lie. And anybody who's curious about the situation, doesn't feel like they know enough, just start by looking at a map.
Yeah.
Israel is so tiny. It's such a tiny little sliver, the Jewish homeland, the only Jewish homeland, to say that there's no room for Israel in the massive Arab Muslim world, which is hundreds of millions of people and, you know, curvature of the earth size landmass.
Well, Israel fits, could fit eight times in the state of California.
Yeah, it's
easily.
Yeah.
Easily.
I mean, that's just ludicrous.
Yeah.
That's the one small piece, and the opposition. I don't know what the landmass is of the opposition in scale, but eight Israels fit into the state of California. I mean, it's big, but not that big.
No, it's just nothing. You know, it's 8 million people surrounded by 500 million people. The whole population of Gaza. It's like if they would move, you know, 10, 20 miles away. End of problem. But no, that can't happen. And they just, I mean, imagine if your neighbor came over and started shooting your children and he was holding his child in front of him as a shield.
Right.
At the time that he's shooting at your kids. What, you're not going to shoot back to defend your kids? Of course you are. And then when his kid gets killed because he sacrificed him, right, the child sacrificing death cult. That's what's going on in Gaza.
Yep.
And so then when we fight back to protect our families, you know, we're the bad guys.
Right. Or he paints a big, or he paints a big red cross on his on the front of his house and pretends he's a hospital.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, you almost kind of can't make that up. Like on your list in one of the emails I received, you said it was hilarious that Harvard would go to court to fight against the scholarly mission of the university, merit-based hiring and admissions, viewpoint diversity, and eradicating anti-Semitism and DEI bloat. I mean, that's a fairly concise list, and it does make them sound mentally ill.
Very good. You summed it up much more succinctly than I could.
I mean, it's exactly sad. It's right. It's really sad and kind of crazy. And it's fascinating to me that anyone would feel good about defending that. But it's interesting because even here, we're at the far end of the state from you, and they're having a protest. Let's see if I can pull this up. I thought, are you guys kidding? What the heck are you doing? They're having a protest here. Here it is. It's a call to action. Now, we're in a town with 90,000 people, so it's not a huge place. We're not incredibly diverse like a lot of places. So here, we deserve a call to action. We deserve a representative who puts people over profit, who fights the voices of who fights for the voices of the community, not someone pushing a personal agenda. Show up and disrupt. We're protesting, and they're protesting one of the members of the Board of Supervisors. But it's fascinating to me because they're not just protesting. This is come in block, BLOC. I guess that's a thing now. They call it black block. So BLACK, like the color, and then BLOC. It isn't just protection, it's power. Show up in black and mask up so we can demonstrate. Yeah, so we can resist as one united force. Keep up, we keep us safe. Their writing is almost hard to read because it's just, it's illiterate. I have trouble with illiteracy. My degree was in English as well. It's painful. Actually, I'm like, whoever's organizing your writing, you need to fire them. We keep us safe through unity, solidarity, and action. By wearing all black and having a mask on your face and marching.
They're proud about what they're doing, so let's mask up.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
If your cause is righteous, why are you masking up?
Exactly.
Yeah, show up and disrupt. We're protesting this guy's business. Is it they're going to be in front of his business to reject his leadership and ensure we are heard? Now, I'm sorry, but showing up with a mask and protesting someone's business doesn't make me, the business owner, want to go outside and say, oh my gosh, are you having a problem? How can I help you?
Like you also read to me a lot of words. I still don't know what their position is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
What are they protesting?
Yeah. It's a big zero. I'm not going to promote their thing, so I'm not going to. It's like every day, though. They're going to be there every day. So we deserve a rep who puts people over profit, who fights for the voices of the community. Well, you can't fight for a voice, but okay. Not someone pushing his personal agenda. And I'm like, he's one guy on a board of five people, right? So how much of a voice do you really have? Like 1/5, actually. That would be the math part. God, it's terrifying. It's kind of interesting, though. It just worked out. You would think I did it on purpose. I wish I could say I did. But the second hour today, we have the terrorist therapist, Carol Lieberman. And so she's talking about, you know, all these protesters are terrorist pawns and open the floodgates to jihad in our streets. And I was like, huh, well, this is a nice little bookend we got going.
I mean, listen, they're very cynical, but very organized, well-funded, and they are executing a game plan that they put into place more than 30 years ago.
Yep.
They said, we are going to infect American academia with this narrative that, you know, Israel bad, Jews bad, and that's going to be an intersectionality, you know, with other minority causes. Never mind, there's no logic there, but if we put enough money into it, we can, and repeat the lie often enough, people will believe it, and the teachers will teach it. And it's happened.
Yep.
You know? These people, they got game. They're evil, but they got game. And we have to be aware of what they're doing.
Yeah, and it's really interesting that Dr. Charles Asher Small. I had the opportunity to meet him down at the consulate, the Israeli consulate in San Francisco a couple of years ago. And super, super nice man. But the one thing I walked away with in that meeting was he had said, as soon as you see the rise of anti-Semitism, you're looking at the end of a culture.
Just so.
And it was just like, so.
And that's a lesson from history.
Yep, and he was way ahead. It wasn't a couple of years. It's been longer ago than it was way before any of these things happened. And at the time, I believed him because we've always had anti-Semitism, but it was unpopular, like you said. It was super unpopular.
Well, it wasn't out in the open like it is now.
No.
No.
Now it's like just throw down. I mean, when we were kids, I mean, we were the Irish Catholic family that moved into the Jewish neighborhood, you know. And so they went to Christmas at our house. We went to, you know, Hanukkah at their house. It was fun. We had a great time. And now there's just, it's almost like there's just this massive cultural shift that has made it, I don't know, do you think it's actually culturally acceptable to be an anti-Semite now?
I think there's a few people who would like that to be the case, and they're loud and annoying, but I don't think they represent America at all. Sadly, a lot of the gatekeepers of culture in America, and I'm talking about the mainstream media, they are infected with anti-Semitism, but they don't represent America.
No.
No.
No,
How much time do we have? I'll share a story with you that I'm sure you'll appreciate, but how much time do we have?
Why don't you do that? Share the story, because we're going to take a light break because I'm having trouble typing. I'm having a little spaz attack at the end of my arms here, trying to send him the music I want to use.
but just quickly, you know, when our movie we finished cutting it, it's about a rabbi with a gun, right? So we showed it to a big agent at an agency, you know, here in Hollywood. Jewish guy, completely not religious, and he says, great movie, really entertaining, you guys are going to make good money in streaming. I said, well, thank you, but I think it's a theatrical film. He says, yeah, but how many Jews are there really, New York, L.A., Florida? I said, well, it's an important part of our audience, but a much bigger part of our audience is conservatives, Christians, people who support Israel, and we're going to enjoy this movie. He says, what are you talking about? Those people hate Jews. It's like,
wow.
Have you ever met the people that you fly over between New York and L.A.? Because you are clueless. I mean, you know, I share Torah and authentic Jewish teachings and history with a big audience of 1 million followers on Facebook. Probably half, maybe a little more than half, are not Jewish. They tend to be conservative and Christian. And so I know this audience. I know them very well. And we tested the film, and we know that the film is going to do great with that audience. But the fact that a guy who's a tastemaker in Hollywood with, you know, some kind of power and say is that far off, that mistaken about who America is, you know, tells you everything you need to know about these cultural gatekeepers in America. They've lost the plot.
Yeah. Well, it's a very small percentage of America, like you said, but it's very much like the LGBTQ XYZ crowd. I mean, it's like a 1% group of people that make all the noise, and it makes it look like it's the majority, and it's a tiny minority of people.
No, they're sucking up all the bandwidth.
Yeah.
Hey, so I found the songs. I went on a quest last night. I decided, you know what, Sal deserves some fun songs, not my usual 611 possible options. There must be more. There must be more. And I found this group called 613.
They're great.
Oh, my gosh. They were amazing. They're kind of like the Jewish version of Pentatonix. Everything is a cappella. So all the sounds you hear, none of them come from musical instruments, only the people, these six guys. And the group name is spelled S-I-X, like the actual writing of the, you know, the actual spelling of the number. And then the number 1 and the number 3. So S-I-X, 1-3. You should look them up on YouTube. They are super talented and hilarious at the same time, actually, in some of their songs. So we're going to take a quick break. And we're going to come back with our super fun guest, Sal Lipbeck. In just a couple seconds, you're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
And I think it's going to be a long 8 nights to celebrate the festival of life, commemorate the miracle of wholeness, God, don't. I'm a like a man. Like a man, I'm frying up this food of potato. Yes, I think we're going to have a real good time. I hope this recipe will come out right.
We can never know what it's like only having oil left for just one night. Just a tiny light that shines so true. But then a miracle occurred. It burned for 8 nights through. Don't you know that we're still standing each and every year? Because the Jews are true survivors.
They have a whole montage. It's called Elton Johnica. I saw that. I'm like, this can't be real. Yeah.
Those guys are great.
They are great. They just are really fun. They do a lot of touring, too. I mean, they're not just like some little one-off, you know, group. They've been around for a while, and they have a volume of music. Bill kept saying, that's got to be drums. They've got drums. I'm like, no, I researched. They've got nothing. It's just them. Yeah, really fun. So, Sal, go back to the baby thing, because I don't want people to be cheated out of the story that I didn't read, but I did link. So,
which story?
With Trump's whole proposal to have more babies. So your story linked, the baby blessing, 11 kids in 5 years, actually. That's what I called the show today.
Ah, very good. Very good. Yeah, no, that's a joke from the book, from Let My People Laugh, the greatest Jewish jokes of all time, bestseller on Amazon. But a rabbi is visiting a town. People are coming to see him to get a blessing. And so this woman says, you know, we've been married a few years. We haven't been able to have children. So the rabbi writes down the name of the woman and her husband, and he says, I'll put this note in the Western Wall, right? The holiest place on earth where people come to pray. And if you've been there, everybody writes their prayer on a note and puts it in a crack in the wall there in Jerusalem. So, he does that. 5 years later, he visits his town again, and he runs into the woman. He says, oh, how's it going? And she says, oh, rabbi, fantastic. He says, have you been able to have a baby? She says, rabbi, we have 11 kids. He says, 11 kids? He says, yeah, after you're here and give us a blessing, well, 9 months later, we had twins. And then we had twins again. And then we had another child. And then we had triplets. And then we had twins again. And he says, wow, that's incredible. And tell me, what's going on with your husband? And she says, well, he's in Israel right now. Really? What's he doing there? He's at the wall looking for that note.
I was like, yeah, that's... Gotta be careful what you wish for. So, yeah, maybe you need to shoot that over to the White House next time President Trump goes to Israel. We can...
of course we can laugh, but... It is very true that when a population cannot replace itself, yep, that's a sign that a civilization is dying. I read a really interesting book by this guy, David Goldman, about how civilizations die. And it's that. And if you look back in time, you know, late stage Rome, other empires, it's like the ruling class gets soft and they're more interested in their own material comfort than in raising families and transmitting their values. And then they become vulnerable. to other civilizations, other, you know, nations that are more focused on the future. I mean, in Europe, forget about it. They're not anywhere near replacement. And just in order to have young people around to do the jobs, they invited in this huge wave of immigration. Now they're having huge problems over there, needless to say. And, you know, one of the few places in the world where you've got a population reproducing itself handily is Israel. I think they're like at over three, you know, fertility rates, you know, how many kids people are having.
Right.
And you've got to be, and China, they're also, they have not been replacing themselves. And then, too late, they start to realize, wait a minute, this wasn't such a good idea. We drank the Kool-Aid on overpopulation, but we're not anywhere near overpopulation. Nations need to have a next generation. And when they do, when they start focusing on, well, what kind of a world am I going to hand to my kids, their values are very different. These people who are not getting married, not having kids, not thinking about the future, their priorities are not what America needs. And I think people are starting to understand that.
Yeah, and the whole idea that, well, we can just import all of the workers, I mean, that just... Your point is well taken. It has not worked out well in other places.
You're not importing our culture, you know, and so
exactly, you
end up being somebody else.
Yeah. And I'm all for legal immigration.
Of course.
And when you have legal immigration, it's done in a measured way that makes sense for that country, because you're thinking about, okay, what are the priorities of this country? Who do we need? Who's going to be good for the country? But when it's being done illegally, and laws aren't being enforced, and you have no idea who's coming over the border. And those millions of people who came across over the last 4 years before this administration, we don't know who they are. We don't know where they are. But I think we can be sure that some very bad actors came along with the people who were just... It's not all people just seeking jobs. There were some bad people mixed in there.
Oh, sure.
And I hope to God they don't, you know, kill more Americans, but it's... That's something we all need to be praying for.
Well, that's kind of the thing, is when you bring people in and there are no, you know, my thing is always, if it doesn't work with kids and dogs, it isn't going to work anywhere else either. And with kids and dogs, you know, you have no rules, nothing good happens. You don't get good kids or good dogs. You have to have framework and rules. And a process, real process.
If you love them, you have framework and rules. It's for their good. It's a framework and rule, of course.
Yeah, the idea that we just, you know, throw the doors open and everybody just comes running in and gets to do whatever they want.
Yeah, our immigration system worked for many, many, many years, but there was a screening process, and we brought in the best, the brightest, and the immigrants that came in had to be able to provide for themselves, had to have a skill. Had to be healthy. We did none of that in the last few years. I mean, there were people coming across with diseases and no job skills, couldn't speak the language. I mean, and it's all coming back to roost right now. Look what we have. I mean, we've got a mess right now we're trying to clean up. And how do you go about doing that without looking like an ogre, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the real kicker, because then you're mean, right?
You want to hear another joke?
Yes, please.
A little bit relevant, but we'll definitely make people laugh.
Yes, love your relevant jokes.
In my book,
if you haven't noticed,
in my book, the jokes are all numbered because, you know, sometimes you need the greatest joke for a toast at a wedding or for a lunch with business or a golf outing. You know, depending on the situation, you need a different kind of joke. And so I have lists at the front, you know, greatest jokes for those situations.
Oh.
So this is joke number 73 in the book. Right? And it says, back in the days when millions of Jews lived in the villages of Poland and Ukraine, a young Torah scholar was soon to be married. And he heard about an old couple who never had a fight in 60 years of marriage. And he was eager to learn their secret. So he walked for days to hear the husband's story. Finally met him, the old man says, the day after we married, I went to my in-law's house with a donkey cart, and I loaded all of my wife's possessions into it. We set out for the new home. After a couple hours of walking, the donkey suddenly stopped. My wife walked around in front of the donkey, looked him in the eye, and said, that's one. an hour later, the donkey took another unauthorized break. My wife said, that's two. An hour after that, the donkey stopped again, and he wouldn't budge. My wife walked around in front of the donkey and said, that's three. And then she pulled out a gun and shot the donkey dead. And I said to her, don't you think that's a little excessive? And she said, that's one.
Yeah, that's probably true, too. See, you have to have rules. Clear, concise rules, and you've got to set a good example. Oh, my gosh. Well, so what are you seeing on the film side of it? I know you had mentioned a little bit that, you know, they were a little bit stupid about whether or not like Guns N' Roses would be popular, or is that what they were thinking? It wouldn't be popular, or would just wouldn't get the view? You know, the
this moron thought that non-Jews would not enjoy a great action thriller about a man of faith who stands up for his community when his community is attacked. Now, listen, the movie has to be entertaining, but we know it is. I mean, we tested it in front of audiences. People love it. Before we made this thriller, I took myself back to film school. My wife and I set up a projector and a screen in our living room, and we watched a thriller a day.
Oh, no kidding.
Like, we just studied the thriller genre. And we said, we were just determined to deliver a really exciting, action-packed movie. And we did that. And the fact that the man of the cloth is a rabbi, I mean, that makes it particular. I know a lot about this world, and I'm able to make him a very distinct character. But of course it's universal. I mean, you know, people of faith have more in common with each other very often, even if they're different faiths, than they have with people from maybe their own background. But, you know, who are militantly secularist. And there's a lot of people like that in the culture, sadly. But, you know, we can all identify with a man who's called to stand up for his community when the community's in danger.
Yeah, and there, you know, that's not... There are all sorts of... there are all sorts of things like that. I mean, even if you go back to the series MASH, you know, you had Father Mulcahy. There he was in the middle of a war, you know. That's not a new idea, but I'm curious, when did you start this project? Was it before or after the October 7th?
It was before. We actually shot the movie at the end of 2022. Now, we knew, sadly, that a movie about Jews under attack who fight back would always be relevant.
That's true.
And what was actually, when we... You know, we have this large audience who's interested in what we share about Jewish wisdom, Jewish content. So we knew it was going to be a Jewish movie. And it was going to be a thriller. We weren't sure exactly what it was going to be. And then there was a terrible tragedy, a shooting in Poway, California. A young white nationalist who had been radicalized online, and who knows if he ever met a Jew, walked into a Chabad synagogue at the eighth day, the last day of Passover. Killed a woman, Lori Gilbert Kay, shot the rabbi, shot his fingers off, and would have killed a lot more people if his gun had not miraculously jammed, and then the congregants chased him out. And I actually drove down the next day. I attended the funeral. I interviewed the rabbi. I watched him become a national figure. And doing something that the rabbi in Guns N' Roses does, and it's such a Jewish response, you know, when there's a tragedy, what we learn from our sages, from our history, is to make something meaningful come out of that tragedy. To call on people to do acts of kindness, acts of charity, acts of righteousness, in the name of the departed, of the victim, of the dead one, and to make some good happen that wouldn't have happened otherwise. You know, it doesn't restore the dead person to their family, but at least it adds some kind of meaning to the tragedy. And the rabbi did that and was very inspired by that. And so that was part of the genesis of the project.
Wow. Well, your timing obviously was excellent. We have to take a really quick break. I'm actually not as far behind as I thought. I do hope people go to the website. I've got all this stuff linked. I've got your site linked and all the different projects. But when do we eat? We should talk about that a little bit when we come back, because the little subheader is sex, drugs, and matzo ball soup. Which I'm like, and the picture is hilarious. So anyway, I just thought that was pretty funny. So we found our friends at Six with 613 did one on Seder. So thought we'd bookend this part with Seder. And when we come back, maybe you can tell people what Seder is for those who do not know. Our guest,
delighted.
Yes, our guest today is Salvador. Goes by Sal, though. We should just keep calling him Sal. Sal Litvak. So he's now our pal, Sal. Nobody else's pal. We've got him today. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I cleaned the house and got rid of the hummus. Now the Seder's where I go. Me and my fam at the table eating matzah like the Hebrews long ago. So come over, we start Passover Seder by blessing the wine. And we washing our hands. And we grab parsley, dip it in the salt water, and break the middle matzah in half.
And now singing like, girl, you know I want matzah. Matzah was handmade by my father before me. Thanking God that we were freed, led out of slavery in Mitzrayim. Said, boys, now we'll drink four cups, spill for the place, and go off with the magid. Thanking God that we were freed, thanking God that we were freed.
Washings again before the meal can begin, and eat the matzah our forefathers ate. They had to leave swiftly, no time to add yeast. Now we've got unleavened bread on the plate. Take a bite of the mara so we remember the horrors of our lives as the Egyptians flee. And for roasted to death, we put it on matzah and then eat hillel sandwich, then shulchan aruch.
And we're singing like, girl, you know I want matzah. Matzah was handmade by my papi for me. Thanking God that we were freed, let out of slavery, Mitzrayim.
Pretty tricky that you can have a song about all that. They just did such a good job. Okay, so Seder. Give people the elevator speech on Seder. How about that?
So Seder is a holiday meal that we enjoy once a year when we celebrate Passover. Truly, we commemorate God rescuing us from slavery in Egypt, right? With signs and wonders, with 10 miracles known as the plagues. God pulled our people out of slavery in Egypt. And then that becomes the setting for the oldest joke known to mankind, right? It's Exodus 14:11. So, and you can just hear a Jewish guy from Brooklyn saying, right? We've left Egypt. Everybody should be absolutely fine, right? God performed 10 miracles that we would leave Egypt. But now our backs are to the sea and the most powerful army in the world is coming after us, to kill us. And the guy turns to Moses and says, what'd you do to us? There weren't enough graves in Egypt. You had to bring us out here to die in the desert.
Yeah.
And then, of course, God parts the sea and we make it through. And that happens at Passover. So that's what we're commemorating. And we gather with our families and we tell the story of the redemption from slavery in Egypt, and we eat some special foods, including this, yeast-free bread known as matzah. It doesn't always taste so good, but it is the bread that commemorates that event in history.
I remember going to all of those events. We were really lucky as kids to live in a place where, I mean, I remember as a little kid, we, go to sleep over at somebody's house, and we all had basements because it was in the East, and, we all had our sleeping bags, and we're all laying in the basement, a bunch of little, 9-10-year-old girls. And it's like, well, who do you guys think Jesus was? Oh, well, we think he's a great prophet. Really? So, we have, all these discussions about what it was like to be Jewish, what it was like to be Catholic, because nobody was... Like the idea of being Christian, that wasn't one of the choices. You're either Catholic or Jewish. You picked a team there. And everyone was on a team. Actually, there was nobody who said, I don't know, we don't go to either. That wasn't even a choice. But it was fascinating.
That changed.
Yeah. It was just fascinating, though, because none of us ever considered your side is wrong. Like, you, the way you do it is wrong. We were just interested. We were all interested. And so they did things that had I mean, borscht. I'm a big beet lover. And I was like, are you kidding me? You have a whole thing. You have a whole thing made out of just beets. We were having goulash at our house, right? went to the neighbors for all the exciting food. But
goulash is my favorite food. My grandmother made such an amazing goulash, authentic Hungarian goulash.
See? It's interesting. There's a whole cultural world out there that all these goofy people are completely missing. Just out of hand. They're dismissing it out of hand. These guys are bad. The other guys are good. And a lot of that is not rooted in history, as we mentioned earlier. And I just was adding to the page for today, just in case I air this again, it's May 4th, 2025. But I added the show from October of 2024, former CIA officer Claire Lopez. And we did a whole 2 hours on the myth of Palestine and the two-state solution. And from a national security perspective, Claire just burns that one in, you know, to the ground. It's fantastic. So if you still think Palestine is a state and Palestinians are a culture or whatever, yeah, that's why that joke is always so good. The meme, the big white room with nothing in it, and it's labeled the Museum of Palestinian History.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, there are Arabs, you know, and it's a wonderful old culture, a lot of tradition. And there were Arabs and Jews, you know, living in the Holy Land. There weren't a lot. You know, it was really a desert. It had become a totally barren place. Mark Twain famously toured it in the 1800s. And he's like, yeah, there's not many people here. This is just a wasteland. But there were always some Jews in Jerusalem. There were always people in Jerusalem throughout all time. And then there was a modern desire to have a Jewish state, particularly, I mean, it started in the late 1800s, Zionism was created, and eventually the British, you know, who won World War I, and so it went from the Ottoman Empire to a British mandate, and then there were Jews and Arabs, and they were fighting with each other because more people were coming, and what really happened was Jews decided we need to have a place of our own, we're going to just move to the Holy Land, hopefully it'll become a state. And they started farming the land using modern methods that hadn't been used before. And they brought this wasteland back to life. And as the farms started succeeding and as the towns and cities started growing, and there was work. And then people, just like in California, people came because there was economic opportunity. And then a lot of non-Jews came also. And from that region, they were Arabs. But they came because the Jews were there. You know, and then you started growing these two populations side by side. But what's so interesting is that, you know, if you look, I don't know much. I'm not no kind of expert on Arab and Muslim culture, but I once participated in a fascinating panel called Sons of Abraham, where we've got three dads, a Muslim dad, a Jewish dad, and a Christian dad. So just comparing our experiences. The Muslim dad asked us to read this book about Muhammad, a biography compiled from the earliest sources by an Oxford professor who had converted to Islam. So, I mean, it could not be more fair and generous to Muhammad and, you know, really the history the way Muslims see it. And but what's interesting is that he grew up in a place where feuds and war of honor, you know, that never, like, there's a stain on your honor, it never goes away. You can never let that go, even if it takes two, three, four generations to get the vengeance. You can never let it go that there's a stain on your honor. Muhammad had to fight many times just to create his religion. And so, you know, war is a little bit of a part of the Quran and the way that it's developed. And this idea of conversion by the sword is real. But the main thing is there's this concept of Dar al-Islam, the House of Islam. And if a region of the world gets conquered and becomes part of the House of Islam, and then later it gets reconquered by the non-Muslims, so that's a stain on the honor, and they can't let it go. And that's really what's happened. The fact that Israel was created, really the center of that Arab-Muslim world, you know, for some people, obviously not for all, but for some people in that world, it's an unbearable stain on the honor. And so it doesn't matter what land you offer and what concessions to peace you want to make. It's the existence of Israel that is the problem for those people. And so when the original offer was made, the two-state solution, that, you know, we're going to create two countries for you. This is Britain talking. So the two-state solution is called Israel and Jordan. And it was going to be 50-50. And they're like, no way, we will not accept that. So they made Jordan 80% and Israel 20% of that landmass. I'm like, okay, but the Jews only get one-fifth. But now you can guys can both have your country. And they're like, okay, we'll take Jordan, but Israel can't exist. They've kept that up ever since. And, you know, people should just do their own research and look at the history, but that's a pretty succinct and accurate summary.
Yeah. Yeah, Claire... Claire did a really nice job on that with the history and the political underpinnings of that and how that, quote, two-state solution has been tried a couple of times and obviously failed both because of exactly what you just outlined. There's no real interest in that. It sounds good, but there's no acceptance that the Jewish homeland can be a thing.
Right. Americans just can't understand because they're like, well, no, but everybody wants peace. So
right.
Obviously both sides want peace. So if there's a war going on, it must be because it's our fault.
Right.
No. We keep offering the country. We've offered it many times. And in that world, in that part of the world, what they respect is strength. You know, so we have to be strong.
Yeah, you have to work with what you have. And I think that part has been just impressive that nobody's, well, we also did another show with the same lady. We called it Operation Beeper, which was probably kind of mean-spirited, but it was about the pager, the operation that the Mossad did with the pagers.
And Operation Grim Beeper.
Grim Beeper, yeah. Yeah, I forgot about that, Grim Beeper. These guys take security seriously. When I went to the consulate down there, I had the address. I was supposed to go there. Like, it wasn't like I was wandering along and just happened on in. I was going there on purpose. And I have to tell you, it was incredibly difficult to find. It was almost like the hidden door. And then once you got in, it was like, oh, and you weren't in once you were in. Then you had to go in some more, and then you went in some more, and it was almost like the Panama Canal, but in a building. So you went to the locks, you know, the door locked behind you, and the door in front of you wasn't open yet, and we were in the middle. And it was, I have to say, it wasn't scary at all. It was super impressive, and I thought, wow, this is like the safest meeting I've ever been to in my entire life.
and then it wasn't necessary.
Well, and then Charles Small and I went out. Dr. Small and I went out the doors. We were chatting about his project with ISGAP, and you know, then we were accosted by drug addicts and homeless people, and it was like, can we go back in the building? Like, we had to ride on BART. Terrifying, but it isn't something, you know. People think. There's no pressure, but I think even in LA, you said you're encouraging people in your community to learn to defend themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's unfortunate that has to be done, but you'd be kind of a dummy if you didn't. I mean, honestly. So,
you know,
tell us something funny, Sal. Let's end on something funny because I got Bohemian Hanukkah queued up here.
For 6:13.
Yes.
Okay, here's one your audience might like. This is joke number 63. So let my people laugh. Greatest Jewish jokes of all time. Bestseller on Amazon. So a fleeing Taliban terrorist, desperate for water, is trudging through the desert when he sees something in the distance. Praying that it isn't a mirage, he hurries toward the object, only to find a little old Jew selling ties from a rack. And the terrorist blurts, "Give me water." "Sorry, no water. Would you like to buy a tie? They're only $5. "Infidel, I don't need a Western adornment. I spit on your ties. I need water." "Sorry, no water, just ties, but they're pure silk and only $5. "A curse on your ties. I'd twist one around your neck and choke you, but I need strength to find water." "No. So you don't want to buy a tie from me, and you hate me, and you call me infidel, and you threaten my life. But I fear only God. So I will tell you that if you go west over that hill for about 2 miles, you'll find a restaurant. They serve fine food and all the ice-cold water you can drink. Go in peace. Grumbling, another cursed and desperate terrorist staggers west over the hill. Hours later, he crawls back, nearly dead, and he gasps, "They wouldn't let me in without a tie."
On that note, we have to unfortunately say goodbye to our guest. Oh, Sal, it's been terrific. Thank you so much. We hope your movie is a huge success.
Thank you.
And I hope people go and check all this out. Guns N' Moses coming out this summer. Our guest has been Sal Litvak. We'll be right back.
Thank you so much.
With the terrorist therapist. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Is this the eighth night? We light with family. Recall with great pride our escape from great tyranny. Kindle the lights. Remember the Maccabees.
How did those five boys lead us to victory?
They stood up against mighty foes.